toward the end of chapter 19. Just ran out of time, had a couple of verses left on Sunday morning. And our objective tonight is to try to talk about that and at least a good chunk of chapter 20 this evening. Again, chapter 17 presented to us the downfall of the power oppressing God's people in the form of this great harlot that John describes as drunk on the blood of the saints and riding on this terrible beast. In chapter 18, you have a similar picture, just different details of a city of Babylon that is laid waste. The emphasis in chapter 17 really was on the immorality of this oppressing power. In chapter 18, the emphasis is on its wealth and its luxury. In chapter 19, after Babylon has fallen, there's a contrast between the mourning you see in chapter 18, all the lamenting and weeping and wailing by all the kings and the merchants and sailors and so forth who had benefited from the wealth and trade of Babylon, and now that's all gone, and they're all mourning that. There's a contrast in chapter 19 with the rejoicing of the saints. We looked at this a little bit on Sunday morning. We looked at the fourfold hallelujahs, rejoicing over the fall of Babylon, the announcement of the marriage supper of the Lamb to His bride. And let's refresh this. Who is the bride of the Lamb? Okay, the church is. We are, all right? And then you have a vision of the victorious Christ. Remember that great battle a few chapters ago that the dragon and the beast and the false prophet were getting all these armies together to make war against the people of God. They brought them to the mountain of Megiddo, to Armageddon. We're going to see that battle finally. But first you have this image of the victorious Christ. And he's described faithful and true, the Word of God, King of Kings and Lord of Lords, all kinds of the characteristic descriptions of Jesus Christ, the glorified Christ that we find throughout Revelation and in other places in the New Testament as well, are here. And He is leading His spiritual army into battle. And here's where we concluded Sunday morning, verse 17. John writes, "Then I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried with a loud voice, saying to all the birds which fly in mid-heaven, come assemble for the great supper of God, so that you may eat the flesh of kings and the flesh of commanders and the flesh of mighty men and the flesh of horses and of those who sit on them and the flesh of all men, both free men and slaves and small and great." Earlier in the chapter, you had the announcement of the marriage feast, the marriage supper of the Lamb. We talked about a little bit about the typical celebration of marriages that might take place in the ancient Near East. Now you have another feast. This angel is inviting the birds to feast on the flesh of the enemies of the Lamb. He's saying this before the battle even ensues. We have a visitor with us, by the way. Just make him feel welcome. That's a state bird, by the way. Did you know that? Yeah, in competition for mosquitoes for the title of Florida state bird. So you have this invitation from the angel calling out to these birds to come feast on the dead bodies of the enemies of Christ. It's a grotesque kind of invitation. But he's speaking of the battle as if it is already done. Verse 19 says, "I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies assembled to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army." And so what we are expecting in Revelation is a long, detailed description of this intense, extended, pitched battle between the forces of good and the forces of evil. What do we get instead? Yes. A cheeky little booger, isn't he? What do we get instead? Yeah. We get two verses, a very brief description. The beast was seized, and with him the false prophet who performed the signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. Kind of, you know, refreshing us about all the things they had done. And the beast and the false prophet, that's the two beasts from chapter 13, are seized, and what happens to them? They are thrown alive into the lake of fire, which burns with the lake of fire, which burns with brimstone. And then verse 21 describes the fate of the armies that had assembled behind the beast and the false prophet, which is what? What happened to them? All right. John describes them being killed with the sword, which came from the mouth of him who sat on the horse. And then, just like the angel invited them, all the birds were filled with their flesh. And that's it. That's the Battle of Armageddon described very briefly. It's quick. It's over. The beast and the false prophet are seized, thrown alive into, this is John's first mention of, the lake which burns with fire and brimstone. Or some of our newer translations may have something like molten sulfur or something like that. Okay, Roger. Yeah, I think that's right. That's something we really didn't bring out Sunday, but I think that's a good observation. And that is that the description of Christ on the white horse in chapter 19 really reads more like the triumph that a general, the triumph parade that a general would put on after the victory, instead of an army marching out to go to battle. And I think Roger's right. That's probably by design. We've seen so many statements in Revelation where the certainty of God's judgment is such that that it is stated as a done deal even before the fact. Well, the prophets do that a lot. Even the Old Testament prophets do that a lot. But I think that's also something you have here in chapter 19. The rest, verse 21, were killed with the sword that came from the mouth of him on the horse, and just like the angel had invited, the birds were filled with their flesh. So, Let's tick off the list of enemies that have been eliminated now. What happened to the harlot in chapter 17? All right. Yeah, the beast she was riding on turned on her and destroyed her. What happened to the great city of Babylon in chapter 18? All right. It fell. It was destroyed. What happened to the beast that rose up out of the sea in chapter 13. Now in this chapter, what's happened to it? Thrown into the lake of fire. What about the beast that came up from the land in chapter 13, which is also called the false prophet in Revelation? What happened to him? Okay, also thrown into the lake of fire. How many enemies do we have left? Okay, all right, yeah, we get everybody that sided with the beast. Remember, Revelation divides people into one of two camps. You're a follower of the Lamb or a follower of the beast, okay? So they're all out of, they've been dispatched. Who's left? All right, the dragon. Yeah. The dragon that was behind all of this, Satan, still remains, okay? And that's what chapter 20 is going to deal with. Up to this point, the judgments that have been brought forth have dealt with the forces that Satan is using to persecute God's people. In this case, the beasts representing the political power and the religious power of Rome. The great city of Babylon representing, say, its economic power and its wealth, for instance. The harlot representing its immorality and ungodliness. All of those things kind of wrapped together. That's been taken out of the way. Because remember, for the people to whom Revelation is first written, that's the face of evil against them. Their own culture, their own government, the Roman Empire, used by Satan as a tool to oppress God's people. Now, that tool has been judged and it has been eliminated. But the force behind it still remains. Chapter 20 is going to talk about that a little bit. So here's what we're going to have in the 20th chapter, after the defeat of the beast and the false prophet, in chapter 19. We're going to see in the first three verses, Satan is bound. We'll talk about the significance of that. The saints reign. Then Satan is finally defeated and destroyed in this chapter. And then the chapter concludes with the final judgment of the dead. In some ways, and you know, John, always remember this, neither the Holy Spirit nor the Apostle John put the chapter and verse divisions in Revelation. And sometimes I kind of wish that the fellow who did this back in the Middle Ages had done things a little bit differently in some places. It might be kind of helpful if the chapter break came not after chapter 20 and verse 15, but between verses 10 and 11 of chapter 20. But we'll talk about that a little bit later. But we can still get the point of what's going on here. So let's look at, this is lesson number 24 in your workbook, chapter 20 in Revelation. And I'm going to preface our discussion by saying this. Chapters 19 and 20 are some of the most difficult in all the book of Revelation. And a lot of fanciful and wild theories that grow out of interpretations of chapters 19 and 20. Chapter 20 in particular, a lot of times, myself included, we spend so much time talking about what chapter 20 isn't about that we don't really talk about what it is about. I remember preaching a sermon, a pair of sermons on premillennialism, just very briefly, and I talked about chapter 20. And I talked about all the things that aren't in chapter 20, and then I got done and somebody said, well, okay, so what's Revelation 20 about? What is there? And I thought, you know what, that's a good reminder. I talked about what it doesn't say, and I didn't really talk about what it does say. I said all that to say, what we're going to try to do tonight is talk about what it does say. We'll have occasion to talk about a couple of things that are often read into Revelation 20 that really aren't there. But my purpose, as it has been all through this study, is to look at what John really is telling us, what the Holy Spirit really does want us to get from the book of Revelation. So in verse 1, John sees another angel coming down from heaven, and what is this angel holding? Okay, he's holding the key to the abyss, or to the bottomless pit, some translations have it, and a great chain in his hand. What does it sound like this angel is going to do? Yeah, he is getting ready to lock somebody up, right? And who does he lay hold of in verse 2 to lock them up? All right, the dragon. And John reminds us in verse 2 who the dragon is. The dragon, the serpent of old, who is called the devil, who is the devil and Satan. John's just given us just about every description there is, every name there is, to identify who this enemy is that this angel is binding. And he bound him for how long?
1,000 years.
Okay. We're gonna look at a few verses, then we'll talk about the significance of that in just a little bit. We're going to come back to it. And he threw him into the abyss. How does verse 3 describe what the angel did with Satan, with the dragon? Threw him into the abyss. Okay. Yeah. He threw him into the abyss. He shut it and sealed it over him. It's like he throws him into a pit, and then he puts a lid on it, and then he seals up the lid. So this is a very definitive kind of action that the angel is taking. And for what purpose, according to verse 3? What is this to prevent Satan from doing? All right. So that he will not deceive the nations any longer until the 1,000 years are completed. And then at the conclusion of verse 3, John adds a note, after these things, he must be released for a short time. Okay? Keep that in mind. What does John see in verse 4? Okay, And what are these people doing that he sees? What happens with them? All right. He starts out by saying, I saw, and the language at the beginning of the verse is a little obscure. You have to keep reading in the verse to put it all together. He says, I saw thrones and they sat on them. Or I saw thrones and those who sat on them. Well, who is that, John? Judgment was given to them. Okay, John, who? Well, then he explains, I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded because of their testimony of Jesus and because of the word of God, and those who had not worshipped the beast or his image and had not received his mark on their forehead and on their hand. So who is it that John sees? All right. He sees them. One of the questions that verse 4 raises is John describing, just one group of people or two groups of people? Is he describing, he's obviously at the first statement talking about the martyrs, those who were killed for the testimony of Jesus Christ. He also describes those who had not worshipped the beast or his image and had not received his mark. And it may be that John is giving two descriptions to describe not only those Christians who had been martyred, but also those who had, even if they hadn't been martyred, had been faithful during this time of persecution that so affected these people in Revelation. And he says, they came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. Some translations say they lived and reigned for 1,000 years, but really the sense of the verb is they came to life or came back to life and reigned for 1,000 years. And then you have a parenthetical statement in verse 5, and verse 5 concludes with, this is the first resurrection. Okay. And what about the rest of the dead according to verse 5? What about them? I saw these dead martyrs, they came back to life, they reigned with Christ 1,000 years. What about the other dead? They stayed dead. Yeah, that's right. Okay. He said, they did not come to life until the 1,000 years were completed. Verse 6, blessed and holy is the one who has a part in the first resurrection. Over these, the second death has no power. But these will be priests to God and of Christ and will reign with him for 1,000 years. Okay. This is the part of chapter 20 that is always so troublesome for us, for a lot of interpreters. Let's talk about a couple of things. First of all, John, I think 6 times in this chapter, mentions a period of 1,000 years. And he mentions it really with reference to 2 things. Number one, the binding of Satan. He says this angel binds Satan for 1,000 years. And secondly, he talks about souls of the martyrs who come back to life and reign with Christ for 1,000 years. Here's the question. Is John describing something that's literally going to happen and last for 1,000 years? Because I will tell you that is a very, very common interpretation that is placed on Revelation chapter 20. Okay. I mentioned a teaching or a viewpoint that is called premillennialism. And we call that premillennialism because it's this idea that Christ returns and that is followed by 1,000-year literal reign of Christ on earth. There are a lot of variations of that perspective, we're not going to pursue all the different flavors of it tonight or anything like that. But you need to know that it is based on Revelation 20, verses 1 through 6. In fact, I dare say if it weren't for Revelation 20, verses 1 through 6, we probably wouldn't have a doctrine called premillennialism. That doesn't mean that these verses are insignificant. They are. But just be aware that that's it. And it, you know, going back a long way, people have read these verses and concluded that this is describing some kind of situation in which Christ comes back to earth and reigns over a literal kingdom. Usually the view is it's a restored kingdom of David with its capital at Jerusalem. Jesus is literally reigning over that for 1,000 years. All right, and I already, you know, I know when I asked the question, I saw a lot of people going like this. No. Why, if you don't think it's literal 1,000-year reign that John is describing here, why don't you think that? What's your reasons for that? Jeff?
Symbolism and all the numbers all the way up to this point have had, you know, a different meaning to that. So why would we then shift to a literal 1,000 years just based on this statement?
Okay, all right. We've talked a lot about the symbolism of numbers in Revelation. Virtually without exception, if John describes a number, whether it's a period of a number of people or a number of years or months or whatever it is, there is a symbolic intent to it. There have been several occasions in Revelation where John describes something in multiples of 1,000. It's 10 times 10 times 10. Remember, the number 10 symbolically conveys the idea of perfection or wholeness or completeness. And when you cube it into 1,000, it's just amplifying that idea. And we've examined the symbolism of all that. It seems strange that numbers would be used literally here to describe 1,000 years when they're used figuratively elsewhere. Jane. Okay. All right. Sure. Okay. Sure. Just in this context, you have an angel with a key and a chain who throws Satan into a pit. It binds Satan with his chain, throws Satan into this pit, seals the pit over him. Okay. Do you think that John means us to take the key and the chain literally? That there's literally going to be an angel with a literal chain who binds Satan and throws him into a literal pit? Okay. No, nobody puts that interpretation on Revelation. Even the premillennialists don't put that interpretation on Revelation chapter 20. There's just a number of things in this very context that are obviously symbolic. Why make the 1,000 years literal in the middle of all that? It doesn't make sense to me. Roger.
The other one that jumps out to me is that these are the saints who have been beheaded.
Mm-hmm.
So the apostle Paul gets raised from the dead.
Oh. Okay. Oh, that's good. Okay.
The people who want to be a part of this group,
yeah.
You don't get to be a part of this group unless you actually got beheaded.
Okay, right.
So if you take it literally.
Okay. Now, that's a great example. John describes people who have been beheaded for the cause of Christ. Do you think John means to say that people who were killed in some other fashion for being Christians don't get to participate in this? Is that what John wants to say? No. And again, I can't think of an interpreter of any stripe that would put that construction on what John says. But if you pressed the language literally, that's what it would convey. This is one of the, and we talked about this from the very start of Revelation, this is one of the pitfalls that a lot of Bible interpreters fall into when they get to Revelation, is cherry-picking certain parts of the vision or certain symbols in the vision and trying to make them literal while interpreting lots of other things figuratively. And this is one of the favorites. The 1,000-year reign of Christ and the 1,000-year binding of Satan that John describes in chapter 20. Well, okay, so what does it mean? When John says, for instance, that after the defeat of the beast and the false prophet, Satan is bound for 1,000 years and sealed in this pit, what does that mean? What are the Christians reading Revelation back in AD 95 or whatever supposed to take away from that? What are we supposed to take from it? All right. Let's talk about the other side. He talks about these martyred saints reigning with Christ, sitting on thrones, reigning with Christ, being resurrected and reigning with Christ for 1,000 years. What does he mean? Now see, this is the difficulty that we run into in Revelation chapter 20. And let me suggest just a couple of things that even from the perspective that we have been pursuing in Revelation, of understanding that this is apocalyptic language, that it is teaching, it is prophesying in picture, it is figurative, it is symbolic. Okay, Satan is bound in the first part of Revelation 20. What does that suggest? I mean, Satan we would say he's thrown in prison. All right. What does that say to you? Is Satan going to have the same free reign that he did before? Okay. There's something in this symbolism that suggests to us that Satan is limited in some way, that he's defeated. And remember, later on in the chapter, Satan's going to be thrown into the lake of fire just like the beast and the false prophet, where that just hasn't happened yet in the sequence of Revelation. Okay, up until right here, what has Satan been doing in the book of Revelation? And how has he been doing it?
He's been using the Roman government to persecute Christians, and it almost seems like there's going to be this period of rest, of peace, that Christians wouldn't necessarily be persecuted to the levels that they experienced.
Okay, all right. What Satan has been doing throughout Revelation is using these, you know what, ever since those movies, I can't use the word minions with a straight face anymore. It has ruined it. Okay, but Satan's minions, Satan's accomplices, in this case, the Roman Empire, he has been using it as a tool, as a very effective tool to persecute and oppress and threaten the people of God. And now that tool has been taken away. Gone. It has been thrown in, every vestige of it has been thrown into the lake of fire. With respect to his use of the Roman Empire to persecute the Christians, Satan has been defeated. He has been stopped cold. At the very least, what we can take from this is that Satan is not going to be able to oppress or attack God's people that way anymore. Now, does that mean Satan's all done? What happens a little bit later in this same chapter? He's bound for 1,000 years, and then what? He's released for John says, a little time. Where we have difficulty is trying to assign time periods to what John is talking about. A lot of commentators, a lot of our brethren, have taken the 1,000 years in one of a couple of ways. One being that it represents basically the totality of the Christian era after the fall of the Roman Empire. And their take on it is that the gospel has free course and makes a lot of progress unimpeded by the level of persecution that you read about in Revelation, the level of persecution these people were experiencing. But presumably, maybe at some point relatively close to the return of Christ, there is an increase in Satan's activity. The problem is, you know, how would you even begin to determine, are we in that period or not? Are we in the 1,000 years or not? Others, with a slightly different twist, just took this as an extended period of, again, peace, relative freedom for Christians, a golden age of the spread of the gospel, and then you read commentators, well, are we still in it or not? There'd be a lot of variations to that. But those are a couple of possibilities. I want to suggest something else. And that is, as we've seen in some of John's descriptions of time periods before, it's not really a time period with which John is concerned. I'm just going to suggest this, and you take it for what it's worth. But that the 1,000 years for which Satan is bound represents the totality of the defeat that Satan has suffered with regard to using the beast and the false prophet, the Roman Empire, to persecute the Christians. On that front, he has been completely shut down. Done. Now, does Satan have other tactics at his disposal? Sure. Can we expect him to use them? Yes. But he doesn't have this particular tool, the Roman Empire, a worldwide empire, essentially, that had control over the greater portion of humanity. Doesn't have that. And likewise, when it says he must be released for a little time, that there's a contrast in that between the ineffectiveness of whatever else Satan decides to throw at us versus the totality of his defeat represented by the 1,000 years. This is hard for me, but the more I think about it, the more it makes sense. That when John is talking about 1,000 years and a little time, it's really not periods of time he's interested in. That's what he's seeing in the vision. But it's the concepts that they represent. 1,000 years, Satan is completely shut down. He is bound. These Christians don't have to worry, or once that's done, they will not have to worry about Satan using their government to persecute them again. The Roman Empire is gone. He's set loose for a little time. Let's go ahead and look at verses 7 through 9. When Satan is loosed later in this chapter, what does he do? Okay, he goes out to deceive the nations. He's not using the beast and the false prophet to do. He's just going out deceiving the nations and gathering them all together to make war against the people of God. How'd that go for him the last time he did it, by the way, when he stirred up a war against God's people? The oppressing forces that he used to make that war were annihilated. That's what chapter 20 has told us, or chapter 19 told us. And ultimately, that's what's going to happen to him. I realize that leaves a lot of questions unanswered. We're going to deal with a few of these things a little bit more as we go through on Sunday. But just, I want us to at least get the main idea of what Revelation 20 is saying, first of all, to these first century Christians. God has defeated every enemy that is arrayed against them. Now in chapter 20, the ultimate spiritual enemy who is against them is going to be defeated. Roger, didn't mean to overlook you. Go ahead. Right. And I think whatever specific interpretation should be attached to some of the details, that is the core message that we need to be focusing on. What about the saints, the martyrs? Where did we first meet? I've harped on this a lot, and now you're going to see why. Where did we first encounter those who had been slain for Christ, those who had been martyred for Christ? Okay, back in chapter 6, they were underneath the altar crying out for God's vengeance. How long, O Lord, until you avenge our blood on the earth? And it was told them, just a little longer. You have to wait a little longer. Which by the way, corresponds to a statement in chapter 12 about Satan just having a short time. Now what position are they in chapter 20? Those who were killed for Christ, what position are they in?
Victors.
Yeah, they're victors. They are ruling, they are reigning on thrones completely. Okay. Again, I think that's the significance of the 1,000 years. Their victory is absolute. Roger.
What we don't see in this context is that reign being on earth.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's in the spiritual realm that they're ruling. Yeah, that's yeah, right. Okay.
Just,
go ahead, James. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I have a little snippet I want us to read, but we'll save that for Sunday since we're out of time. But I just want you to think about that contrast, because that's really one of the key points of this section. You had those martyrs who had died, they'd been slain for Christ, they were crying out for vengeance. It looked like they'd lost. And now here they are in chapter 20, and they have won. They are victorious. They have a victory that cannot be taken away from them. And again, what happens to Satan in verse 10? This is looking forward to, you know, no matter how many times and in what form Satan may attack the church. This was Roger's point a little while ago. No matter what forms of persecution or temptation he may use, ultimately, this is what's going to become of it. He's thrown into the lake of fire just like all these other enemies of God were. That is his destiny. The only question is, which side do we choose? Because remember, in Revelation, two sides. You're on one or the other. The call is to choose. The call is to be faithful. The call is to, in John's words, overcome. That's what these Christians in Revelation 20, the ones sitting on the thrones, the ones reigning, that's what they did. Even though they died, they still overcame. There are worse things than dying. The rest of the dead, you know, John describes, they didn't overcome. They had sided with the beast. We'll clean up some more of those details on Sunday morning. And we'll look at the great judgment scene that begins in verse 11 and look at the new heavens and the new earth that are described in chapter 21. Questions or comments before we finish up tonight? Okay. Thanks for hanging in there with us, and we'll talk a little bit more about it Sunday morning.